G-69, ICA headquarters, Buenos Aires, Argentina. In a grand ground floor media room, whose decor and layout had far less in common with the room William Godfrey had used for previous GSC and GCC events in the same building than it did with the famous room he had long admired within Richard Walker's IDA building in Colorado Springs, the presence of the inaugural chairman of the Interspace Contact Agency was hotly anticipated. That imposing American building now just as famously served as the global headquarters of Fiori Frontieri, and a common factor linking this inauguration with Godfrey's previous high-profile agency opening ceremony in Buenos Aires was the presence of a small contingent who were in attendance on behalf of Timo Fiori. Alessandro Bonucci, without doubt Timo's most trusted colleague and the closest thing to a right-hand man the typically solitude-preferring billionaire had already taken his designated seat in the second row, along with a second Fiori Frontieri staff representative. Most of the other seats were also filled, with only the most senior delegates having opted, or perhaps having been instructed, to arrive at the last moment. As an amiable sort, the young and handsome Alessandro had many friends within the room. Having spent years as a prominent and uncontroversial astronomer, Alessandro had long been independently renowned in his field, even though the world had no idea he was the true discoverer of Comet Il Diavolo. Precious few knew that he had more than gladly allowed his more senior colleagues to claim the credit for what was officially designated Comet Conte Abate, so as to avoid his surname being forever linked to what could have been a catastrophically damaging galactic wanderer. Equally few knew that it had also been Alessandro who informally christened it Il Diavolo. His companion in Buenos Aires and Fiori Frontieri's second representative was Natalia Ricci, Timo's designated policy advisor. Timo had long viewed Natalia as a safe pair of hands, having placed her in charge of improving his public image many years earlier. She was far more conservative than the other PR expert who had since come into Timo's life, but he was very pleased that Emma fully approved of Natalia's presence in Fiori Frontieri's official ICA delegation. Emma had spent no time with Natalia in a physical sense, since the latter rarely left Italy, but the two had spoken fairly extensively over the past 2 weeks in both video calls and text-based correspondence. Natalia's English was as perfect as Alessandro's, and in limited interactions to date, she had been getting along well with Chairman Godfrey too, which certainly made things easier for everyone. How much of a meaningful role she would play in Buenos Aires was anyone's guess, and since Timo had primarily sent her there to fight any fires that might arise, it was widely hoped that her input would be kept to a minimum. Natalia was a very petite woman who walked and sat in a manner that made her easily missed, quite by design. She wasn't trying to be invisible, but she likewise made no effort to make her presence known. Emma McCarthy, she definitely wasn't, but Natalia was good at her job and Alessandro was very glad to have her at his side keeping watch of the political sharks and media manipulators dotted around the room among the generally friendly crowd. Most in the room were repeat visitors to Buenos Aires and had taken to Alessandro quickly during his brief presence in the building during its previous life as the GCC's home base. While he was popular enough among the individual delegates, however, Alessandro's boss was far from so universally liked by their governments. Things had changed somewhat in that regard within the past year, with the billionaire's recent hesitation about the ICA's breakaway from the UN having softened the way in which he was viewed by some of the Western European governments who had once been his primary detractors. The opposite was true, too, both in that Timo had long criticized the mainland European leaders he saw as weak and ineffectual, and in his softening towards them. Timo was currently recognized as the world's richest man, and had spent more time in that spot than anyone else in the past decade, with the level of power and influence this wealth brought often bringing him into conflict with national and regional politicians. These days, he took a back seat from the kinds of highly ambitious property developments and business acquisitions that had helped to expand his fortune. Timo's wealth management strategies were increasingly passive, and his interest in them even more so. What had excited him for the past 5 years had been space exploration, and the search for ever deeper contact with intelligent alien races. This latter focus had initially been on the discovery of alien life, with Dan McCarthy's decisive role in that regard having then raised Timo's goal towards the establishment of ongoing contact. It had been a bumpy ride across terrain marked by geopolitical tensions, competing organizations, and an increasingly impatient and sometimes even hostile public mood. So no one was more glad than Timo that the ICA's day had finally come. There was no ego within Timo Fiori's heart, despite what many ill-informed media outlets and biographers had written throughout his remarkable life to date, and those who understood his previous firm opposition to this kind of ICA breakaway appreciated the fact that he had sent a delegation. Timo himself had recently enjoyed a reunion and full reconciliation with Dan after a frosty period when they had been on different sides of the argument about the ICA's ideal home. Their relationship had been strained to breaking point over the issue, with Timo's side having held that the best place for such an important global agency was within a time-tested United Nations framework with the checks and balances that provided, and having insisted that reform was possible and certainly preferable to throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Dan, however, had firmly believed that the ICA could far better enable meaningful cooperation with the messengers as an unconstrained solo agency capable of reacting far more nimbly and adaptably than the veto-based voting structure at the UN would ever allow. That neither Timo nor Dan and Tara were in the room hadn't gone without notice, particularly the titled duo from Birchwood, who several other delegates had seen arriving at the building earlier in the day. And it seemed certain to all who were in attendance for the inauguration ceremony that Chairman Godfrey would have to at least acknowledge and likely explain their absence if they didn't arrive with him. Alessandro Bonucci had been fielding the Timo question all day, despite the fact that his boss had never once suggested he would be in Buenos Aires in person. The primary reason for his absence really was the one Alessandro mentioned each time he was asked: the memory of the terrorist attack at Fiori Frontieri in the unstable days of Il Diavolo's unchecked approach were simply too fresh in Timo's memory. Timo had been gravely injured in that incident, which occurred during a major media event in a room that Alessandro couldn't help but notice bore a truly striking resemblance to this one. Given that Emma had been at Timo's side when the blast struck and was herself knocked into a coma, it seemed to Alessandro as though Godfrey would have an easy way to explain Dan and Tara's absence from the imminent ceremony too. All three of these high-profile absentees were highly sympathetic characters in the collective public mind and were held in near universally positive regard, so both Alessandro and Godfrey knew that the chairman's explanation would be readily believed by the billions of viewers at home. How well it would go down in the room was far less certain, given that everyone understood that a second shelter had been discovered on New Kerguelen, but precious few knew any more. Some naturally understood that Dan's unparalleled closeness with the messengers meant that he would know, and throughout the past 2 weeks, Godfrey had been relentlessly pursued by both the media and a horde of national delegates for answers. Many clearly assumed that Godfrey knew more than he did, but through his frustration at being left in the dark by Dan, the titanic Englishman tried to console himself with the point that not knowing the truth made it easier to say so with a straight face. Among the event's attendees, only Godfrey and Chinese Premier Ding Ziyang knew that Dan McCarthy and Billy Kendrick had ventured to New Kerguelen in the aftermath of the second shelter being discovered by a joint Chinese-American crew who had been sent from Earth to repair the first and so-called Great Shelter, under which the entirety of New Kerguelen's native population had lived for many thousands of years. The unidentified crew member who leaked news of the second shelter had also leaked the fact that New Kerguelen's external atmosphere appeared to be perfectly safe for both humans and the physiologically similar messengers, at least according to every piece of data the crew's extensive instrumentation was able to collect and analyze. This, in turn, led to all manner of speculation. But to date, the real truth that the messenger's great shelter was in fact a great cage put in place by a deceptive and all-powerful third race had understandably gained no serious traction as a plausible theory. Not a single person had publicly espoused any theories postulating that the messengers may have been used as little more than guard dogs by this hypothetical third race, much less that the beings they sought a buffer against were humans. The only other piece of information the public had to go on when it came to speculating about the known discovery of a second shelter on New Kerguelen was a piece Clark McCarthy unthinkingly but undisastrously revealed from the Birchwood drive-in in the minutes after Dan and Billy's return from the distant alien world. Clark's statement had been replayed endlessly and analyzed within an inch of its life, with body language experts having also appeared on several news stations while it aired. All they concluded was that Clark was telling the truth, however careful he was being not to say too much, given that his posture and expression perfectly matched the famous words. Unfortunately, our friends on New Kerguelen have found out some pretty sad things about their world and its history. Fever pitch wasn't a strong enough term to describe the level of borderline hysteria in some segments of the population about what Clark might have been alluding to, and he had understandably stayed out of the public eye ever since making his comments. No one else within the Birchwood inner circle was angry at him for saying too much, however, since he had entirely stayed away from the truly crucial to avoid topics. That Dan had just been on New Kerguelen, that he had discovered the truth about the elders and how their presence enabled a deceit grander than any he had encountered on the countless thousands of pages of science fiction his eyes had devoured since early childhood, and most importantly, that his trip had been motivated by a desire to rid his daughter Piper of genetically inherited uplift powers that the world at large could quite simply never learn anything about. Alessandro Bonucci, for his part, didn't feel personally slighted for being out of the loop about anything. He perfectly well understood the need for secrecy in certain situations and knew that bringing any more people into the fold than necessary, regardless of how trusted they were, increased the chance of a slip-up. Almost as importantly, the young Italian also recognized that knowing too much, or more accurately, being known to know too much, could make a looped-in individual a target for all kinds of nasty surveillance. Alessandro's role within Fiori Frontieri meant that he had high security at all times, but typically in the form of plain-clothed and embedded agents. Only on days like today did he arrive with such conspicuous protection. Ever since Clark's speech at the drive-in, Alessandro had been informed of recent failed hacking attempts on his own online accounts and digital devices at 8 a.m. every morning. Even more disturbingly, he had also been told that his parents' home in Milan had been visited in the dead of night by two individuals who attempted to plant physical bugs, apparently in an attempt to capture audio recordings of any phone conversations they may have had with their son, before being scared off by the conveniently timed arrival of a passerby. While grateful that this passerby had shown up when he did, Alessandro was shaken not only by the bugging attempt, but by the implicit revelation that his parents' home on the other side of the ocean had already been deemed worthy of protection. What troubled him was that protection in turn implied surveillance, that the home he grew up in was evidently being monitored closely enough for the good watchers to have noticed the bad ones. This had shaken Alessandro quite significantly, and although it tore him up on the inside, he decided to keep the news from his parents. Frightening them would achieve nothing, he ultimately decided, and a burden shared would not have been a burden halved. What did come out of the bugging incident was a passionate discussion with Timo over the importance of what they were doing in enabling meaningful cooperation with the messengers. Alessandro never doubted nor questioned this importance, but Timo stressed it in such an articulate manner that he felt as though he would never doubt it no matter how invasive the negative attention might become. Alessandro felt like this and sat relatively comfortably while he waited for Godfrey's arrival and the commencement of the speech that had brought everyone to this packed media room. But he had no idea just how far their opponents were willing to go.